2012, when Cootie was sold, entrepreneurs woke up to the opportunity for Irish whiskey.
Okay.
And every Tom, Dick and Harry all of a sudden was like, oh, I've got a plan. One distillery. Like, you know, I've got a shed in the back end of Beyond, and I'm going to put a distillery. So there's a lot of noise. And I really said, well, look, we have to do this. We have to do it now.
Hello and welcome to episode 26 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. This week, we have a special, very special guest in Mr. Jack Teeling. Jack is the founder and CEO of Teeling Whiskey. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. Jack founded Teeling Whiskey when he left Cooley Distillery back in 2012, which he was chief executive of, and he was part of the sale team. Cooley was started by his dad, John, back in the 80s. So they have a real family history of not only entrepreneurship, but Irish whiskey as well. This was a chat I was looking forward to for a long time. Jack was one of those people I had on my hit list from before I even started the podcast. So it was a real buzz to sit down with Jack and just spend an hour literally learning from one of the best entrepreneurs of our generation. There's a real movement in Ireland at the minute around entrepreneurs and people starting businesses, and Jack is one of the people paving the way for that. It was an honor to sit down with him. I hope you enjoy the chat. There's a lot of nuggets of really good information in it. I've just listened back to it again myself. And just common themes cropping up now in the podcast that you can kind of spot and kind of pull out. Jack shares a lot of those kind of like nuggets. So I dug a little deep into his habits and what drives him and what motivates him and kind of traits he shares with other entrepreneurs we've chatted to already. So kick back, grab a coffee, grab your notebook, take down some good notes because there's a huge amount of info in it. Enjoy the episode.
Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be part of it. So
so we'll kick off just kind of like we're sitting here in Dublin 8, right beside your distillery. So is this your first entrepreneurial venture?
Yeah, it's my first, let's say, fully owned or, you know, my concept. I was involved in quite a number of entrepreneurial ventures or, you know, companies that were relatively early stages but weren't my concepts. So I got quite a wide experience in entrepreneurial cultures and be able to deal with the risks involved and the uncertainties involved with startups. But there's nothing quite the same as your baby, this is my first effort at striking out on my own, and thankfully it's going reasonably okay.
So what did you start off doing then? Did you go to college or did you just start?
I started off, it was beaten into me at a very early stage. My parents were the first of their whole family to ever go to university, so I had no option. I had to go to university. It was something that was very important for them. So from an early age, I was mapped out to go to UCD. So lucky enough, I got into UCD. I did a BCom there. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. Specialised in management, and then even when I was finished to become, didn't know what I wanted to do, but then I decided I want to make some money. You know, I was like, you know, I don't know what I want to do, but I want to be able to make money. So I decided for my sins I'd do an MBS in finance. So I went straight away after 3 years in UCD out to Smurfit Business School and did finance out there. And it was very much geared towards getting into investment banking and treasury operations and all that kind of stuff like that. And really, coming from a non-financial background, it was kind of it was a bit of a challenge, but enjoyed it. Most, I'd say 90% of my class went to London.
Okay.
I did one or two interviews over there. I'm very happy I didn't land anything. I actually ended up getting a job working as a trainee dealer in Anglo-Irish Bank of all things back in the 80s. So I got exposure to entrepreneurial banking as well, which was great. I'll be honest with you, it was a great place to work. Very young, they looked after stock quite well. I worked in the treasury side of things. They wanted me to be an FX trader or dealer. I didn't do it to me. I liked the equity side of things. I worked in the equity desk, and then they spun that out as a private banking. So I actually ended up working in private banking, Anglo-Irish private banking, based on Fitzwilliam Square.
What is private banking? You hear that term thrown around a lot.
Yeah, well, basically their whole concept was to try and get people who were overexposed to property to diversify into shares and bonds and other alternative investment classes. And they had bought Ansbacher, which was like a basically for rich people, and they'd have their deposits there and all this kind of stuff. So they had a bunch of things, but it was really like a stockbroker, to be honest with you, when I was there. So I was technically the guy who was buying the shares on behalf of the customers, and they were treating you the same way, which I enjoyed, but I never saw a long-term future in it for me, because it's either an industry you make part of your life, and you know, it's very much becomes an extension of your social life. And I never really kind of saw a long-term future for me specifically in that. So I decided I'd take a chance. Went to Australia. I ended up working in finance when I was there as well, and just different kind of roles. And then you know, traveled for a bit, and I came back. And I was given an opportunity to, because I didn't really know what I wanted. You know, didn't know what I wanted to do. And all this energy, all loads of ideas, but you know, I was still very young and kind of trying to find my way. And my old man said, "Ah, come in, and you know, someone's trying to buy a coolie. Why don't you come in and see, you know, the process and all the things?" So I said, "Okay, look, I'll do it for 6 months, and no matter what, I can use this a bit of headspace to figure out what I wanted to do." But I was there 12 years later.
So, Cooley Distillery was one of the original, I guess, distilleries in Ireland.
It was. So my father set up in 1987. It was the first new distillery in over 100 years, and at that stage broke a monopoly. So there was only one producer called Irish Distillers that was set up in the 60s and 70s to try and save the Irish whiskey industry. And it was encouraged by the Irish government to bring together the last remaining families to create a viable proposition to survive the onslaught of the Scottish distillers, who were really doing very, very well. But you know, with anything, monopolies aren't the most efficient and the most dynamic. And my father, having gone to the States to study, saw firsthand what the opportunity was for, or saw how well the Scots were doing, and imparted a seed in his head that there's an opportunity to do, you know, Irish whiskey better.
So he could see the impact in the States.
Yeah, I think sometimes you have to leave the country 100%. To see the opportunity. Because in Ireland, it was very, you know, it wasn't dynamic, they didn't see anything past the little rock that we live on. And I think he got this global perspective or the opportunity by going to the US and you know, just studying the history, studying what was happening now, and saying, well, look, these guys aren't at the races, because I see them firsthand how they're marketing Irish whiskey in the US. They're not doing a good job. There's definitely an opportunity there. But it took him a while to go after it. So he came back and worked as a lecturer in UCD, of all things. You know, he again, a little bit like yourself, I think he was in his 40s, decided that he was going to walk the walk and set up a couple of different companies in the 80s. And Cooley Distillery was one of them, but also mining resource companies as well, because he had been exposed to well creation from the zinc finds that were made in Ireland in the 70s and 80s. And he was involved in working with them, and he just saw that you can make a lot of wealth if you could find natural resources, and Ireland has you know, certain natural resources, but internationally there was lots of different things. So anyway, so he set up loads of different companies, and I suppose I was brought up around that. So around the kitchen table and talking about all these different things, and different businessmen coming and going and talking, you know, bottles of whiskey turning up on, you know, and all these different things like that. So I was also encouraged, I remember at an early stage, was, and I suppose the reason why I started off in finance was my dad got me to pick shares in the business paper. So that, and then every day I would then get the newspaper and look at the share prices. And
what age were you?
I'm trying to remember, I was like early teens or something like that. So
it's amazing.
And just to realize that, oh, you can buy, you know, one share of Ready Mix or something. Or CRH, and you know, it goes up and down, and there's, you know, all you do is you buy, you have £10, you can buy a part of a company. So it was really eye-opening to me in terms of how that worked. And I always had that interest in, and that's probably the first why I was attracted to finance, and why I was attracted to the equity side of working here. But getting to work in Cooley back then, it did open my eyes to the opportunity and what making something actually is. And I quickly found that there was a big opportunity for me to add some value to what my dad was doing in Cooley, and that they'd done amazing things. in terms of surviving in the 80s and 90s and getting to a stage in the 2000s when Irish whiskey was just about to explode. They'd done all the hard work, they had the inventory, they had the whiskey, they had some brands. And because there had been a lot of uncertainty about the ownership and people were trying to buy it, a lot of the original commercial and the marketing team had left. So it was a gap there, and I kind of ended up going into that, and I decided I was going to give it a go, and I went back and did a part-time master's in international business and marketing that was being done, the very first enterprise R&D executive education course that was with Trinity and IMD, and I used that to kind of reskill myself and give myself a bit of a focus on what I would do within Irish whiskey. Mm. And so that was back in 2003, 2004. And I slowly but surely crawled my way up from being dog's body up to the sales and marketing director in 2007. I became the managing director in 2010. And because of the structure of Cooley was PLC, I was buying bits and pieces of share. So some of the original shareholders were dying on buying shares. So
back to your teenage years, except on a grander scale.
Yeah, but I was getting, I was increasing my equity, and I think, I was always looking for opportunities. I was always looking at it because I always wanted, I'll be honest with you, it was my dad's venture, and that's always the way I felt.
Right.
Like I was in it.
Yeah.
But not me, if you know what I mean. I always felt like it was his.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask you. Was it a hard transition into the family business? Was there a bit of...
I didn't see it. I never saw it as a family business.
Interesting.
So I didn't see it as a family business because it was a public limited company. We only had a percentage of it.
Okay.
We ran it as a public company. Mm. So it wasn't like it was a traditional family business that decisions are made by family members. Board meetings and all that kind of stuff like that on a regular basis. We had AGMs with 300 shareholders turning up. Oh. So it was...
When did you float?
It wasn't floated, so it was non-listed. So that's why I could actually buy some shares. So there wasn't a lot of liquidity in it. So people had shares when we died or they wanted to liquidate it. We created a market for it, so it allowed me to basically increase my share, but like on a very slow, steady state. Because it had that structure, it was run in a different way.
Okay.
And that's why when someone came offering to buy it, it wasn't like, the family had to decide.
Okay.
The shareholders had to decide. In fairness to my father, he was very conscious of his responsibility to the shareholders. More so than creating a legacy with the family.
Right.
Because there were a lot of people that he brought in. And as he said back in the 80s, he was the young Turk, he was the young guy. And so these were of a certain age that invested in them. So they were quite old.
Okay.
From 2012. And reality is a lot of them had lost a lot of their pension as a result of the recession. So when someone created a way to monetize an investment that they probably didn't put a lot of value on.
Might have rode off liquids. Back in the day.
Jeez, let's just, let's grasp it. So, but no, look, I think it worked out for me because I said, if the deal's done, I said, I'm gone.
Right.
I'm going to do my own thing.
Had you one eye on the future then of your own thing?
You're always thinking there's always trying to find an angle or an opportunity. I was never property. Property wasn't something that attracted to me back in the, probably because again, it wasn't something that I had exposure to. I didn't have, obviously a strong tech background or anything like that. So I was trying to think of where I could add value. And, I looked at, for example, Five Guys franchise back in 2009, 2010, and actually they were, was nowhere down to that stage, but I had found it in the States, liked it, and had some fast going. So I was looking at just, and then I was like, I'm either all in or I can't do all these things at the same time. So at that stage, I'd made a commitment that I'm going to try and make this work for Cooley. I can't, I don't have the energy or the resources to spread myself too thin, but I was always looking at it.
Yeah.
So even from an early stage, and I'll be honest with you, I said I'd never work with my father just because that's just the type of one. I remember even when I left, I ended up going, Jack is different. And I take that as I didn't strike him as the atypical lifelong banker, which is fine, it's grand. That's just some people are made for that kind of corporate life and some people aren't. And I'm definitely.
Was your dad trying to pull you back into the business when you're doing the banking?
Not really, no. Like, it's as I said, it was never mapped out that this is to go into it. So it was a bit unusual when, I think it was unusual timing when I came back from Australia, in that I was looking, I wasn't dead set to go back into finance at all. I didn't know what I really wanted to do. Everyone goes, oh, go find yourself, and you know, you'll figure out what you want to do. You come back more totally confused than anything else.
Yeah.
Because you just, you know, there's so many options of what you can do. And you know, even back then it was 2001 .com bubble. So,
yeah,
you know, all that kind of, there was other challenges then. People forget about it.
There's always something. People always forget that. People always look back and go, oh, it must have been great back then. It's always something.
Yeah, exactly. So there was, you know, things weren't extremely buoyant, you know. And as I said, if you wanted to go down that route, you kind of had to go to London. And I didn't want to do that. I had been away from my girlfriend for the whole year, so I was dead set trying to make something work. And I said, look, I said, I'll go in and try and learn from my dad, because you don't, you know, you perceive different things when you're a kid. And then, like, you know, and then the reality of working is, you know, is this all work is? And then, you know, so I went in fairness, now I got, as I said, I got exposure to a multitude of different things. And it was my time in Cooney that really, you know, I learned that I'm not good at managing upwards.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm much better at taking full responsibility for my own actions and not having to answer to anyone else. Yeah. And, you know.
Definite entrepreneur there.
I was just like, my parents are, I'm the awkward one. I'm always the awkward one. Like, you know, I am the awkward one, but hopefully, you know, awkward in the right way. And always, you know, I think I can manage uncertainty and grey environments well. As I said, I looked at all the options back in 2012, and I said, well, look, what can I do? I could do lots of things. I could just stick it into property, and I probably would have made a truckload of money. Everyone was offering all these things, but I said, look, what do I know? Where do I see the biggest global advantage for us? And I had, you know, a certain view of what the opportunity was with an Irish whiskey, and I didn't think anyone in the world had a better chance of making success than I did, because I'd been at the coalface. I saw a lot of things that were working, a lot of things that weren't working.
So when you sold, what happened then? You sold out, and then that was you gone from the business.
Yeah, so as I said, look, if the company sold, so we had actually the president and CEO of Beam Inc., a guy called Matt Shattuck, English guy, ex British Army, you know, nice guy, very good. They came in and they sat down in our office, and he goes, oh, there's lots of great opportunities for the Teeling family, you know, going forward, because we're like, we're brand custodians, we'd love to keep you on. I said, well, look, if the deal's done, I'm gone. I'm just telling you that right now. So just to be aware, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not working for you guys. And they were like, a bit shocked, but, you know.
Was that because you felt your time was done, or was that because you had this urge to do something yourself?
Oh, I wanted to do something myself, and I didn't want to be, you know, when you're used to basically, you know, being a big cog in a small machine and be able to make decisions. Like, I never, like, if I wanted to work in a multinational, I would have gone after the opportunity. Gotcha. I didn't want to work in a multinational. But it was the opportunity.
Yeah.
It was just like perfect opportunity. And everyone's like, oh, were you nervous? No, it was great. It was like, you know, very, I would say, I'm trying to cruise. Relieving, or it was something like to get the monkey off my back, or something I wanted to do. But I'd been thinking about it quite a bit, so I kind of framed what the opportunity was. And so when the opportunity came, it was easy.
Right.
I think what I'd say to a lot of people who are trying to, or working in companies and want to do something themselves, is think about it. You know, you see all these little nuggets of information, you know, keep them and feed them, so that when you're ready to cultivate them, when the opportunity comes, and you know, it's never, it's unusual, it's a perfect opportunity, because normally there's, you just have to make a jump.
Yeah.
But for me, it just seemed perfect. So I could have stayed on, I could have learned from the big multinationals, or I could have milked them for money, you know, in terms of having a good employment contract, but it was, no. So now was the time to go, and it just worked out perfectly, and it was very relieving and energizing, and you know, it was a great, really enjoyable time. And those first.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and they sell their business, and it's also like,
oh,
a sense of grieving.
Oh, there was, oh, totally. That was to, you know, but I talk about going out and doing my own thing, but there was definitely a grieving because we put a lot of time and effort into it. You know, for me, they were, I was only starting to put my stamp on it.
Right.
You know, 2010 to 2012, and I had a vision of what we could do with the business, but like, as I said, I wasn't probably very good at engaging with my father and the board to bring them along with me. Because, you know, I felt like I didn't have to do it. You know, it was just the, unfortunately, family dynamics and just the type of person I am.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, it's a bit difficult coming in because they had so much ownership of it.
Mm.
You know, you're trying to change things, maybe remove some of their decision-making abilities and put a little bit more structure on it. It's a big cultural change.
Okay.
And I think that probably made it easier for them to accept the deal because they probably felt that things were moving away from them rather than, if you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the business going the right direction, but.
So kind of it suited everybody, lined up for everybody. You saw like clean slate,
yeah,
green grass, plant my own, just get going.
Yeah, but look, as I said, go back, there was an element of grieving in terms of the mindset, but at the same time, it was also a relief and creating this, you know, blank canvas for me to get stuck into. And literally went after doing all the things that I wanted to do that I couldn't do, like in terms of designers and so forth, and pulling together the team and the range of skill sets that I thought we needed in the short term. And the key thing was getting whiskey. If you have whiskey, you're in the whiskey industry. And then evolving and changing to make it unique and interesting. So you know, it was a couple of things fell into place that were unusual and probably couldn't be repeated. Was it because timing was lucky or because I knew, you know, where whiskey was or who the people were? I think it was a combination of both.
Mm.
But definitely timing was more of a luck thing. Like if the company was sold now, let's say if Cooley was sold now, I think we get a much higher price, substantially higher price, but the opportunity for what I would have done, it would have disappeared.
The last, what are we now, 7 years?
Seven years, yeah.
Crazy.
It's when I look back, I worked for Cooley for like, I think it was 11 years or something, going on 12 at the end, but you know, 7 years, it just disappears so quickly, like, you know, it's crazy.
So 2012, you sold, what then? Did you go Lion Beach for a while? Did you decompress?
So it was 4 months I had to stay.
Okay.
With just a handover. So it was closed at the end of January 2012. So really the deal was done in 2011, but it closed. Got our money in January 2012, and I had to stay on until the end of April, so May, my job then was they wanted to fire a lot of our distributors, which I found quite difficult, because these were a lot of customers that I would have brought in.
Okay.
So I had to send letters off to do it. But then that was done, I did it, and I actually got a supply contract of some whiskey out of them. And having a supply contract, there was no non-compete, which was great, so obviously I could get sucked back into.
Okay, so they actually wouldn't start to supply you.
Well, that's because I was, as I said, I'm a bit of a difficult guy, and so we started getting a little bit difficult just before the end of agreeing the deal, and in fairness, my dad did support us in terms of the view that, look, I know you guys don't want to work, or no, I don't want to work there, so I'll help you get what you need out of this before we sign the deal. So okay. Just near the end, I got a head of agreement, and this is where the Teal & Whiskey Company name came from. I literally had the heads of agreement had to be signed on that day because we were literally signing off on the overall deal back in November, and I just said, oh, Teal & Whiskey Company, just call it Teal & Whiskey Company, put it in the head.
Where did that come from?
It's like literally, you know, it's a simple name, it's Teal & Whiskey, you know, make sure that it's something that, you know, if your name is on it, you can stand behind it. So rather than Dublin Whiskey Company, you know, the Teal & Whiskey Company. And again, I knew family had history dating back to a certain time in Dublin. Didn't know the details of it. I got to know them early in 2012. That gave me confidence then to use that as our overarching brand name. But look, it was just something I needed very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it just made sense to me at the time. Yeah. Don't ask me why, but it just...
And when you put your name to something, it's deep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and again, there was... When I decided to put Teeling Whiskey as a brand, you know, you have your friends go, geez, you're so egotistical. You put your name on the bottle and you're putting your signature on. Who the hell is he, Gary? Like, you know, they're heading you.
Only in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but it gave a lot of customers that I had reached out to try and work with again confidence that we were in it for the long haul, and that, you know, it gave a bit of credibility. So if I kind of tried to mirror the strategy that Cooley had been set up, which was these older brands like that they acquired, like Kilbeggan, Tyrconnell, all these old brands, you know, I don't think it would have meant as much or as easier to re-engage with some of the customers that we actually had.
Yeah. So you signed that agreement to get a whiskey supply. That was one of my big questions for you, because it can be a very time-intensive business. So how long does it take for whiskey to mature?
Well, it depends. You know, legally, it's 3 years and a day. But like, you know, you can have whiskeys that are 30, 40, you know, 50 years old. And so the starting point was getting the supply contract, and that was for mature whiskey industry. But then we had acquired some casks personally that I brought as well, some really old whiskey inventory that was the backbone of the company as well. But then the real transformational period was there was an existing customer of ours in Cooley who bought lots of truckload of whiskey. And I knew that they weren't going to use it, and they were looking to probably sell it at some stage.
Were they investors or another company?
They were another large player within the spirits industry.
Okay.
They just bought it as let's say, when they're planning a product that they have, it was to give them the ability to a stretch target. And they thought, look, let's invest in this, and the worst case scenario, we can sell it if we don't need it. And they didn't need it. And that really transformed the opportunity quite quickly. So I was always going to be limited with the stock I had, how big I could go or what products I could offer. But this opportunity came up to buy this stock, which came around September, October 2012, really changed the dynamics and gave me the ability to really go after, you know, the opportunity.
So you left in May or you left at the end of the summer?
I went away for 3 weeks to the West Coast of America with my 2-year-old and 9-month-old child, and he killed him going all the way over there to get sunshine, but it was gloomy and rainy when we were there, but then came back. So literally it was the end of May that I started trading or getting involved.
So you went straight into it?
Straight into it. I actually came back, went to London to watch the Heineken Cup final between Leinster versus Ulster, and then went to the London Wine and Spirit Show and met our designer that we ended up doing that weekend, and it kind of went from there.
Wow.
So yeah, it was like,
so you clearly had all the cogs turning.
Oh yeah, it was well on board where I wanted to go. I knew exactly what I wanted to kind of do, knew who I wanted to work with, but there was a couple of other things I had to fall into place to enable us to take advantage of that.
So what was your plan? What was your kind of like, when you left, you're like, right, Teeling Whiskey is going to do this. Had you planned for in terms of the whiskey and then what you want to do with it? Was just me.
It's kind of the brand was kind of where I went, and what, because like the reality is this industry is brand led, and the real value is in brand. So otherwise, you're making ethanol or alcohol. The added value is the brand and creating that brand. And I think that's where we struggled in our Cooley days to really kind of. You know, we were very production orientated. We were okay on brands, but it was, you know, the opportunity was clearly there to do something. And I felt some of the trends that were happening in other craft spirits and other producing regions weren't being done in Ireland. And particularly, I suppose, what was happening in the US, because the US was by far the largest market for Irish whiskey. And, you know, we wanted to try and create a brand that was relevant to these younger premium spirits consumers, that probably, you know, was different to the market leader. So if you went against the market leader, Jameson, you're going to fail. So what we decided, we're going to go above them and create a different brand that for me resonated with, you know, modern Ireland, not this ode to the past, rolling red hills, red centers, and all that crap, which means nothing to me. You know, it was fake Ireland, if you ask me, or fake, you know, my generation of Ireland, and do something that fitted with where we were at that stage in the 21st century and what Dublin was. Very keen on, the concept was to get a distillery in Dublin and to do it in a modern way and create a brand home where people could come and see what you did But there has to be a real distillery. So that was the real kind of the crux of it. When I was trying to find a location, was to try and find a location that allowed us to produce a real distillery that we could have then as a visitor experience as well. And that would be your brand home and, you know, blah, 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 all the different variables that go with it and creating that brand experience and getting the brand global recognition. And at the same time, I was creating a brand that had this look of old and new, that looked like other similar brands in that premium craft spirits business that was happening, you know, across the world that wasn't being reflected in Irish whiskey. And focusing on creating a differentiated liquid that tasted different but was successful at the same time. And using innovative maturation techniques to evolve the whiskies that we had bought and make them distinctly appealing so that there was nothing else like that out there. And we were looking if we could do that. So, you know, it's creating a differentiated premium brand that really went after the white space that was in the category, that was being under catered for or hadn't really, you know, people hadn't gone after because everyone was attracted to where the volume was. Everyone's attracted to Jameson. Oh, look at the size of the opportunity. But that's not when you're a smaller discovery brand, you can't compete in that. You have to go, you have to be differentiated, you have to have added value, you have to be, you know, more premium. You know, I think we learned a lot of things by trying to go after that opportunity and failing. That made it, you know, quite crystal clear to me what we needed to do to, in terms of liquid, in terms of brand, in terms of positioning to hopefully take advantage of the opportunity.
That's a massive ambition.
Well, look, it's a, you know, we're trying to create a global brand, but, you know, if you look at, to me, it wasn't, it was, because it's been done in other categories.
Okay.
It's been done in every other category, and someone was going to do it, and I think, my view was the big guys can't do it, because they can't create brands.
Okay.
So they really struggle to create brands, and I think, you know, it's interesting now, so I'd say, Diageo and Brown-Forman, who owns Jack Daniels, are in Irish whiskey, and they're trying to create a brand from scratch. I'd be very interested to see if they can make a success because they tend to acquire brands. And if you ask any of these big companies, they see themselves as brand custodians.
Okay.
So their brands, they tend to be very old, they've been around a long time, and they've just been passed a parcel from one company to the next, rather than brands that they've created themselves. In particular,
and why is that?
Because it's hard. Big companies are very good at doing certain things, but not necessarily the grassroots marketing that's required to build a premium spirits brand from scratch. I think gin and vodka and white spirits are a little bit different. Brown spirits in particular are different. They're much more of a lifestyle expression. People do as much research about the car they drive than the bottles of whiskey they have in their drinks cabinet.
Really?
Yeah, so it's an extension of your personality. And, you know, for example, Jack Daniels. Okay, Jack Daniels is an instantaneous kind of, you know, big brand, but if you ask consumers why they drink it, it's not because of the taste. Because the buzz they get when they go and go, JD and Coke, they're like, look at me, you know, I'm the man. You know, it's very
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot more to it, and brown spirits in particular tend to have a need for authenticity and heritage, and that anchor to the past. So that's why, you know, you're up against the Glenfiddichs or the Jack Daniels or the you know, the Jameson brands have been around for hundreds of years, and they've got to where they are because of, you know, different owners doing different things at different stages.
And how do you make a new brand feel old?
It's a very, very tough question, and I think, you know, we use our, and this concept was to go back to where our family first started, very first started. One was to get away from recent baggage of Cooley and my involvement with that, but also to bring that authenticity and to give us the right to do what we're doing here in Dublin now. Why should we be allowed to have a distillery in the city centre of Dublin? Because our family did have a distillery, you know, back in 1782, just around the corner. So we used that as a bit of an anchor, but we were very keen to say, well, that's just justification, but we're not about the past, it's all about what we're doing now, so come judge us now. Mm. And we found, we did some consumer research years ago, and that to be like, yeah, it's great having all this history, but what are you doing today that's relevant to me? You know, that's more important for those younger consumers than, you know, all the past and all this, all that. That doesn't mean anything to them. That actually turns them off more than anything else. And I do think you can take, be respectful to the past, we like to say, but confident enough to forge a new future. so that, you know, we bring unique, different flavors into Irish whiskey, which is a very traditional category. And there is a lot of rules and regulations because it's been done for a long time. But there's still scope to take global inspiration and bring it back to Irish whiskey and to push the boundaries of what people expect. And that's what we're doing. So all our products, you know, they seem innovative, but they were being done in other categories.
Okay.
You know, the design house we went to, they've done innovative packaging in every other category except for Irish whiskey. So to me, it was a great, different lens, come in and see if they come up with something different. You know, we picked the bottle because it was an old style bottle, and that we could be that link to the past, but still look cool. Mm. You know, younger people would still, I thought it looked cool, and I always wanted to do something with it. Mm. So there's things like that. I think you can combine the two. And we were looking when we were building the distillery, so what way do you want to look? Because you can't recreate an old style distillery. If you do, it looks crap.
You see certain pubs try to do that, and you're like, it just doesn't feel right.
Oh, it's just, you know, it's wrong.
It's neither one or the other.
It's just fake, you know? And I said, no, let's just do something that's new, you know, and industrial, like modern industrial. And I like that kind of strip back, show the services, show the metal and so forth, and just let that be the experience. And hadn't been doing our own, you know, you go to Brooklyn, a place like that back then, it was kind of the look and feel. So we said, well, why can't our somewhere in Dublin look like that? Mm. I remember when we were getting the builders to have the steel girders exposed, they were like, no one does that. That's wrong, what are you doing? I said, look, just paint black, it'd be grand. They're like, no, you're wrong. You'll want us to come back and, you know, put back, you know, build around it. And then he said, geez, it looks all right. Like, you know, it's just, as I said, it's just simple things. Now everyone's kind of doing it. But we just wanted that kind of, this is where we wanted to fit in, but also stand out.
Mm.
And we did have a design for the distillery, which was like a glass box. Like the first architect we had designed this kind of glass box, kind of Audi showroom off the M50 type thing. And that's too far because whiskey, you know, if you go too far away from what the people expect,
it jars the experience.
It jars. Yeah. You got like, there's something not right here. They're trying too hard, or it just doesn't feel right to me. So we have to, again, understand your consumers, understand how far you can push it and operate within that. But still, there's plenty of little things you can try. So with gin, you can have the most elaborate bottle, you know, probably makes you stand out more.
Yeah.
But if you do it on whiskey, you kind of go, maybe you're overcompensating for crap liquid.
Well, yeah, people with pattern recognition, they see the same thing. They're like, oh, that's a whiskey. Yeah, I recognize that, especially as a new brand, I think. That's so really important.
Yeah, we wanted to stand out, but stand out for the right reasons. And we feel that, you know, the design, the liquid, you know, even our logo stands out for the right reason, but it's different. You know, is it different now, given that it's much more competitive marketplace? I don't know, it's a good question, but back then it really was. There was no one doing what we were doing, and I think people have taken some inspiration from us and that we can make it work, that they're confident enough to do things in a different way as well.
So 2012, you started off, you got your whiskey supply, you got your designer. How long then until you saw a bottle on the shelf or held one in your hand?
Of a brand of Teeling whiskey, it was February 2013.
Okay, that's so pretty quick.
Quick, yeah. But we did launch even back then. I did a product called Hybrid Whiskey. Got me a bit of trouble, but I launched a Putchine product as well. So I had a Putchine and a Hybrid malt whiskey in 2012. So again, I wanted to get something out to create a buzz, to get people talking about it, and to also to provide some potential customers something to get stuck into quite. Okay. Because I was a bit of a land grab in terms of route to market, because route to market is very important, and trying to get the supers on board very, very quickly kind of de-risk the business from my perspective, because at least you know where you're going to sell. Doesn't mean you sell it up, at least you have somewhere to go. So even in the first year, I think we were around eight different export markets, like literally from when I started. And the Hybrid Whiskey was, again, the concept was bringing together two different producing nations, like a hybrid car.
Yeah,
you bring them together, you create something more interesting. So this was a combination of some Scottish single malt and Irish single malt to create a hybrid malt whiskey, and I thought it was quite interesting. But the issue was the Scottish Department of Agriculture in Scotland got onto the Department of Agriculture in Ireland, and they brought me in. Legally, I was right,
okay.
But they said because healing name was associated with Irish whiskey, that people, I might be misleading consumers. So I didn't, I decided it wasn't worth picking a fight with the Department of Agriculture over something like this, because I always, Irish whiskey is what I was going to focus on.
Yeah.
But I thought it was kind of interesting, I could have done with Welsh, because it's global.
It's a novel idea, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Other people have kind of carried on since then, but like, I literally had to sign a letter saying I will never do this again.
Really?
I'm a bold boy.
if you're not getting in trouble, you're not moving quick enough.
Legally, we've all been there. The right thing to do. But look, I got it. As you said, it was all about creating a bit of a buzz PR for the whiskey community, you know, in Europe in particular, and it worked. But we worked with the Irish Whiskey Society. So we did a bit of skunks works to try and figure out liquid wise what we could do, and we did a tasting in August in 2012 where we sampled a range of different products, and there's one that we wanted and we thought was the most interesting one, but we wanted to present it to them and help us make the right decision, and lucky enough, either by leading or the reality of it, but they chose this rum married premium blend that became our small batch.
Okay.
And is by far our biggest brand that we still have now. And we used, you know, it was what I thought was that was interesting. And my view was, if you treat a blended whiskey like a single malt, which is a premium whiskey, where you use, you know, unique barrels to layer on top of different flavor and finish those whiskeys, and consumers understand that and really enjoy it, why can't you do it for blended whiskey? And it worked. And it allowed us to charge a premium and have a fuller flavor Irish whiskey that still had the taste profile that people enjoyed and understood.
Okay.
Irish whiskey, which was important for me because the market hadn't segmented. It was still at an early stage of evolution. And if you created a too expensive or too flavorsome brand, you weren't going to go for that white noise. You weren't creating that ladder to get people into that premium.
Gotcha,
expression.
Yeah.
So our pricing, it was pricing strategy as much as anything else. It was like around 35 euros. 35 to 40 euros, same price point in dollars. So make it affordable trade-up, easy trade-up sort of offering rather than going too high. Because if you're a new brand, people aren't necessarily comfortable spending, you know, 100, 200 euros.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Or also they'll buy it, but they won't drink it. So, and I still believe that's where the sweet spot is within Irish whiskey now. And you can see it with the likes of Caskmates and Black Barrel from Jameson, and they're, you know, adding, you know, slightly more premium options to get people up that
value chain. Yeah. So you haven't got your distillery yet. So you always had a plan to put your own distillery in Dublin.
That was the plan from day one. So that's what I said when I set up the company and I was going to, that's what we're doing, you know, but with no real idea if I could do it, I'll be honest with you. But that was literally, this is what I'm doing. Like, even to the Beam guys, I said, look, I'm looking to build a small distillery in Dublin, going after these opportunities, blah, blah, blah. They're like, yeah, whatever, yeah, well, go away. They didn't see too much of a threat at the stage.
Didn't care.
Didn't really care, which was great. At the end of it, if they did, it would have been more problematic. So I came back from London after going to the trade show, and I started looking straight away, and I remember I was on Daft.ie, and just because I'm not a property guy, going commercial properties in Dublin City Centre, that was there.
That was 2012, so things would have been fairly bleak, were they?
Very bleak, yeah. It was really dark days for commercial property. Commercial property was like, you know, 90% down off its peak.
Actually made it perfect for you.
Nothing, but nothing was happening. It was literally, the whole industry was at a standstill. No one wanted to sell, no one wanted to crystallize losses. Everything seemed to be for sale, but not for sale. It was kind of funny. But the first one, the very first place I looked at was in Thomas, just off Thomas Street, in St. James's. It's basically the old lighting world, which was an old church.
Okay.
Which is an industrial building. And I went into it, so it was really cool. But it had listed gates, was surrounded by a graveyard, and it was too small, poking the inside to build a medium-sized distillery. So,
okay.
But it turns now it's the Pearson Lines Distillery.
That's what I thought it was, yeah.
It's hilarious. It was the very first place I looked at in 2012, and I was like, God, this would be cool. It's a little small, like, kind of craft brewery, but not for what we wanted.
Mm.
And then started looking around, and you know, like, where would have the size and the scale to do it? And we talked about the Docklands, and I met with actually the Dublin Docklands Development Authority and the guy that was there, and in fairness, they're offering CHQ and so forth, and it's a bit too expensive, too lovely.
Yeah,
it was perfect, but I'm going to have to wreck it to make it, work for us. And also that has statutory, building regulations that had to be for certain type of things, so you couldn't buy something there and do it. So all the wrong. So it was again my naivety. But he recommended talking to a guy called Kieran Rose, who was a guy in the DCC in the economic development unit, and he had been a planner for Dublin 8, and literally came in and knew exactly what I wanted. And list of 10 places where he thought was suitable.
Amazing.
And I'd say 9 of them were all in the Liberties. And so I said, oh yeah, grand. I remember I drove in to Newmarket Square. Mm. I was like, what the hell? This place is really weird. Mm. It's really kind of freaking me out. So I kind of was like, yeah, I could see it. I could see the warehouses here, but I'm not quite sure if this is the right place. We were looking around and looked at actually really cool places up by the Strawberry Beds, which was by the Liffey.
Oh yeah.
There's an old ink producing place.
Probably a bit too far out. It's
a little bit too far out, but it was a really cool building. But the building was a little bit small as well, and lots of different things like that. So, but it was, I think it was going to get too expensive as well, but it didn't happen. And I was shown another site. A lot of people who had heard that you're looking for, and then were offering these sites to us, but they were offered the old sofa factory, which was on Mill Road, near to the Fumbly Street kind of development. And there was an architect there who said, oh, you should look at this old building. And it was for sale through I think Allsoft's at that stage, and looked at it and said, again, it's too small. But they said, well, there's another kind of add-on to this, and I'll show you this warehouse. I looked at the warehouse, and I had Alex Shaskell, who was our master distiller, he was a guy who joined us just in June, and we both looked at each other and went, oh, yeah, it's all right. But it had a lot of the different things we were looking for, which is like a 10,000 square foot of open plan warehousing space, had a loading bay, had whole range of different things. And I said, well, geez, yeah, it's a bit small on its own, but if you get the warehouse beside it, that would be great. A gentleman that was involved in owning, who was involved with the owners, found out that it was us that were looking for it, and he happened to be from Clontarf, and there was a family connection, and we started talking, and he saw the logic of selling and developing that to help kickstart the whole area around us, and we signed the heads of agreement, I think it was in August, September 2012. But we didn't get the planning permission, all the different variables across the line until 2014. So,
wow, 2 years?
Around a year and a half of doing it. We started off with a design team that didn't work out.
Right.
So we had to go back and kind of redesign it, which delayed things. And at one stage we did get told that we weren't going to get planning if we did submit the planning application, but in fairness, at a higher level in the DCC, they saw the logic and they encouraged us to put it in, and that they would support us in terms of the application. But still, you think, property, anyone in Ireland can object. The previous development that had been earmarked for the site had got 200 observations.
Wow.
But we got none. So we actually played a good game locally in terms of educating them on what we're trying to do, and that it was good for the area in terms of creating jobs and bringing visitors into the areas that would hopefully have a knock-on effect on other things like
timing
that.
As well.
Yeah, it's unknown. So we were delighted, obviously, when it came through. But then there was an added delay in that there was still a tail of a tenant in it, because no one knew for sure if we were going to get the planning permission.
Okay,
The head of agreement was subject to planning, so once we got that, we had to get them out, so it delayed things further. But once we actually started on site, which was mid-2014, we went very quickly. In 6 months, we were well into it, and we had the distillery already designed and all that, and it was like a bit of a plug and play into the warehouse at the back. Right. We knocked down the one at the front, and we opened for visitors in May 2015, or officially it was June, but we still started commissioning and distillery in March 2015 as well. So we went quite quickly, in terms of around 9 months to get the distillery up and running, which is pretty good.
And how did you manage the tandem of almost launching two businesses to three businesses almost. You have the tourism play, you have the distillery, and then you have the property play as well. So how did you manage all that?
Yeah, I think the main business and continues to be is the whiskey, is you know, the export business, the brand building business. So that was the engine to fund everything else. So we had invested heavily in whiskey stock, and we were monetizing, we were developing it. By 2015, we had pretty good international business, but the challenge was to keep that going and to use the cash flow from that to fund thing. And I think the hardest thing was, you know, committing to such a large project and all the costs associated with that, when you literally only had probably around $500,000 in your bank account. When, you know, you're talking 5 to 10 million in terms of the budget for that, and all the invoices falling quite soon. And we're lucky we have a good relationship with Ulster Bank. So the initial stock that we purchased was ourselves, so money went in ourselves. And then we could release equity from that by getting refinanced as an asset-backed loan from Ulster Bank. But there was pressure on us to show that we could monetize the stock, and, you know, confidence around that and so forth. So it was, you know, people say, what's the hardest thing about building a distillery? It's paying the damn bills, literally, when they fall due. And it was stressful. It was, in fairness, it was hard going, trying to juggle a lot of different balls. And I was very involved in this building the distillery in terms of all the aspects of what we do and how it looked and felt. And we didn't have a huge design team. We didn't have like interior designers. We didn't have a experiential, you know, marketing team to do it. It was all like architect, project manager, builders, and us.
Okay.
Which was great. Huge amount of ownership, obviously, on everything that happened. We did it in a cost-effective way. Mm. You know, we probably didn't get things finished, and that's why it was continuing investment to get to deal with things we didn't have the budget to fix or to do to a standard that we wanted. But I think it made it very real as well, and very, you know, I would say unpolished and authentic.
You seemed a very clear vision of what you wanted as well. It also means it's your own money and you need to get money coming in.
Yeah.
I think that's always the difference between entrepreneurs. You see them and they have a great idea and spend years with the business plan and they get funding and they spend another couple of years holding the product and it never gets launched.
No.
It's always in that phase, whereas like you guys knew, right, we have to get this going by X date.
Oh, look, it to me was, I saw that other people were interested, and that you know, there was, I think what happened in 2012 when Cooley was sold, entrepreneurs woke up to the opportunity for Irish whiskey.
Okay.
And every Tom, Dick and Harry all of a sudden was like, oh, I've got a plan. What a distillery. Like, you know, I've got a shed in the back end of Beyond and I'm going to put a distillery into it. So there's a lot of noise. And I really said, well, look, we have to do this. We have to do it now. And we have to do this quickly because the opportunity is now. I'm still believing. Machine's still now, like, you know, we still haven't got there. And there's even more noise. So it was very important for me to move forward and keep moving forward and grasp the opportunity before someone else did.
Mm. You preempted one of my questions there. There seems to have been this just explosion in distilleries, craft breweries. What's driving that?
Well, it's the opportunity is one thing. And I'm always shocked with the amount of risk capital that's been put into Irish whiskey. It seems to be endless sums of money being pumped in because they can't all succeed. The best thought out will, because there's an opportunity there, but it's I think there's a lot of people coming into the industry that don't necessarily understand the challenges that are actually there. Mm. And you know, they just see the opportunity and say, oh, I get some whiskey, get a brand, and sure, rock and roll, and it's as easy as that. Yeah, it is, but that's not set up, you won't be set up for success. Mm. You know, we were involved in our coup days in hundreds of different brands that we did for it, and none of them succeeded. None. Not one. And I see there's going to be probably a similar washout. And I always say there's a difference between a lifestyle brand. Mm. You know, and I think you can have a lifestyle brand and craft brewery because there's not a huge capital cost to get involved in it. There's not, if you can get access to whiskey as a, you know, from a different distillery, you can have your own whiskey quite easily. But, you know, again, you can make it into a lifestyle if that's what you want. But to run as a business is a very, very different way to do it. And it's hard. There's massive barriers to entry. You're up against well-established entrenched players that have, you know, their own route to market and, you know, ability to wash away with their marketing spend. You know, if you don't know that going into it, I think you can hit a lot of brick walls quite quickly. You have to figure out from day one is how do you live in that space and how are you going to survive in that space while, you know, realizing that this is not a short-term play, it's a long-term play. Because, you know, I always say this industry is a marathon. You got to do the right things slowly but surely, build up that base rather than trying to run too quickly, because you run too quickly, just fall over. It just doesn't happen. So it takes time. It's expensive. It's a lot of hard work. And even doing that, there's no guarantee of success. So it's a tough industry, but you know, there is, the dynamics have changed and you'll see it now. I think that the opportunities are bigger for what we do and what other people can do, because the market for a long time was driven by only a handful of brands. And now it's truly beginning to segment and premiumize and evolve. Mm. And if you can create something that can, you know, create your little niche within that, you can do quite well. But you know, I do think you have to have that clearly differentiated brand-led story with a good route to market, with the ability to have continual supply. So that means access to a distillery or a long-term supply contract, and the deep pockets to be able to lay down the stock now, and at the same time as build the brand, invest in marketing to be successful. And that's tough. Mm. That's tough. And I think a lot of people coming into it now are probably looking for a flip. Or trying to find, you know, build something, show that it works, and then try and partner up with another, you know, larger partner. And, you know, I think if you go into it in that frame of mind, you know, I'll be honest with you, you're not set up for success. You know, it's a bit different in tech. Like, yeah. I think if you crack in tech, boom, it goes everywhere, and you can make a quick return. This is not that industry. This is, we're in slow moving consumer goods. Very brand-led, you know, investment, marketing heavy industry that you know, there's very few overnight successes.
And you have your own distillery now, and you're open since 2015?
We opened in for visitors and started laying down whiskey in 2015.
So your own whiskey rolled off the...
So yeah, and it changed the dynamics of things, and it gives you the ability to scale. So, you know, we're getting to a stage where rather than having supply constraints, it'd be demand constraints in terms of what we have. So we've laid down quite a large amount of inventory for future opportunities. Now we have to make those crystallize those future opportunities. You know, it changes that, you know, our cost of goods gets cheaper when it's our own whiskey that we have. Reducing it gives us the opportunity of introducing a range of other offerings and so forth. So you know, we're in a very good place. You know, as you said, I think the challenge for us is now going to be demand and creating that brand. And we're going wider. So we kept it very, very tight in the first couple of years in terms of specialist distribution. So let's say, you know, let's take Ireland, for example. We were in the independent off licenses kind of distribution. Now we're in multiple distributions for our core, our larger brand, while catering for them by more premium, unique offerings as well. We're seeing a similar trend in other international markets, like in, you know, we're seeing in the UK, we're seeing in France, we're seeing in Germany. So that's where we're going to. But that brings its own challenges and, you know, investing in much wider reaching consumer marketing, which some of our partners aren't set up to do. You know, we don't have the budget to do, but you know, we're trying to do as best we possibly can. So grab the opportunity where you can, but sometimes you can get on shelf too quickly and then people don't know who you are, so you fail, and then that's counterproductive. So it's kind of get that balance right.
So what is the future for Teeling now in the next, say, 2 to 3 years?
You know, 2 to 3 years is a relatively short period of time. Like, you know, it's funny, looking back 2 or 3 years ago, like we've come a long way, and it feels like a short period of time. I think you're going to see an acceleration of the segmentation, and as I said, people looking for something different. The opportunity is going to be bigger all the time. It's just we have to make sure that we're the ones to grasp it. I think there's going to be a lot more competition in the space, a lot of noise. Again, we just have to be wise and consistent. and understand what we're good at and keep at it rather than get distracted. So be a confident, you know, brand or company and you know, understand what we're good at and let's continue to do it. We will have an evolving range of products. You know, these will be products that we can have continued availability. So we'll have long-term scalability and we'll go deeper in the markets where we feel the biggest opportunity is. So we're in 65 different export markets at the moment, wow. But it's the 80-20 rule. So, you know, it's a handful and the US is a very important market for us because that's by long way the biggest market for Irish whiskey and a market where is, you know, primed for, you know, segmentation. They're looking for something different. And if we can't grasp it, someone else is gonna do it. So we're, you know, most of our advertising promotion and our spend is going into the US market at the moment to try and make sure that we grasp that before someone else does. But, you know, we're spending a couple of, I don't know, $3 million in the US on that side of things, but it's only a drop in the ocean compared to the price. So
there's been another Irishman trying to crack the US whiskey market recently with his brand as well.
yeah. So and again, look, that's it's interesting because obviously that's hit the ground running. The question I have is longevity on a brand like that. And what is the brand?
Does that almost help you though in a way? In terms of it puts Irish whiskey on the map, or does it confuse the message you guys are trying to put out?
So am I politically correct one or am I real?
Absolutely.
I don't think it's a good reflection of Ireland, I'll be honest with you. It's so stereotypical. It's what Americans think of Ireland.
Yes.
Which is not what we want to present. We want to present what Ireland is, what Dublin is. You know, you go to New York, you talk to like bartenders in trend-setting bars and they have no, like they still think donkeys go through, or you know, they think we're all like McGregor and that we beat the head off each other every Saturday night. Like, you know, it's not. I don't think it's who we should be as a nation in the 21st century. You know, after, you know, I think we're better than that. And you know, the fact that he's when you talk about Ireland, people start going McGregor. Yeah, I appreciate it as what he's done as a businessman, but as a brand for Ireland Inc., it's, I'm just can't take it as a positive message for people thinking of what Ireland is. I'll be honest with you. I think for the category, I think it's interesting because it's a disruptor. He's robbing from other categories, so he's not robbing necessarily from Irish whiskey. He's robbing from things, which is can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I just I in 20-30 years time, I can't see the brand being around. I could be totally wrong. You know, we used to do a brand called Feckin' Irish Whiskey, and people thought it was great, really fun,
yeah.
You know. But, you know, there's a bit of novelty around it. After, is it going to be a consistent repertoire of drinkers, you know, over the long term? I don't know. I don't know, unless you can create a lot of different products. But, like, if you're a younger person, you like MMA, you're going to like MMA in 10 years' time? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how it goes, but they have big backers. They're guys that know what they're doing behind it. It's got a good team. You know, the guy behind Avion Tequila.
Yes.
He knows what he's doing. He's got Proximo, which is pushing those behind it. So he has supply there. He's got a good route to markets. So he is a lot of the things that you need to be successful. So
at least in the short term, I guess.
Yeah, look, as I said, from a liquid perspective, fine, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with the liquid or anything like that. It's, you know, just my own personal opinion in terms of portraying Irish people in Ireland, in America in particular, because they're so, we're trying to challenge that, but you know, it's kind of hard because it's such a big brand and playing the Dublin anger quite distinctively as well. But like, there's a, gives us a counter proposition to kind of go after a slightly different proposition within that space as well.
Cool. I have two final questions for you. I'm conscious of keeping you.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The last question I have, you can think about it for a minute, is what book you'd recommend to any entrepreneurs. Every week we give away a book to someone that's made an impact on yourself. So it can be any kind of book, it can be personal, it can be business, it can be autobiography, it doesn't matter. So all people have to do to win is tag yourselves, tag Teeling, and tag ourselves in it.
Jeez.
So okay. You think about that for a minute.
Okay. Should have told me that beforehand. I'm looking at some time.
A deep thinking book can be anything that you found even interesting or entertaining or got some value from. And then I'll skip back again. And the second last question is, I've chatted to a lot of young Irish entrepreneurs who are in the food space and drink space. What advice would you have for them if you were starting out again? If you were just starting off, some of them have just got a little bit of traction. They might be 12 months in. They're just starting to get a little bit of traction. What would your advice be to them?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things that I would say. And again, even for people who are thinking about it or interested, you know, and looking for that opportunity, is definitely, no matter what you're doing, whatever industry you're in, definitely be open-minded, grab those little ideas, something you see, particularly if you get the opportunity to travel. See what's happening outside of Ireland, because you know we forget when we're here how small we are.
Oh, yeah. Would you go?
Again, every industry is different. Like I'm lucky. I've managed to travel a lot around the world. But you know, within our industry, you know, the US and even anywhere in Europe, like you know, you just see things, little things. Like you know, it's all about taking it by osmosis and keeping them there, because you don't know when the opportunity is going to go. You don't know what, you know, might fall in your lap. And if you haven't thought about it beforehand, it can be overwhelming. So I would say is that process, be constantly processing if you're looking for opportunities, because you don't know when that window will come and you have to be able to take it. And if you don't, you'll probably regret it for the rest of your life. Secondly is to get out there and do it. I'm not a big believer in business plans, I'll be honest with you. They're a necessity, but they're more like guideposts, and you need them for your fundraisings or banks and so forth. But reality is, no matter what you think you're going to be doing, it's not where you're going to end up. And if you don't get out there doing, you're going to be, and you spend so long laboring over your business plans and all that kind of stuff like that, you won't end up getting to where you want to be, in my opinion. And then I think the reality of it is, you know, is be able to live in a certain. No matter where you are, if you're a leader in a company or in it's your own business, or you're a captain of a rugby team, whatever, you have to just be able to make decisions and move forward. And that's something that I was beaten into me when I had the, you know, I suppose the exposure to work with my father in that entrepreneurial culture. You have to just make decisions. You have to just take whatever's around you, impart information, and make a decision. You can change it and you can make another decision, but if you're, you know, and the same if you're a manager in a company, people come to you to make decisions. Make decisions. You have to make decisions. And that's, as a small entrepreneurial company, that's, at the end of the day, the only advantage you have over the beer guys. Beer guys don't make decisions. No one wants to put their head above their parapet. You know, they're big ocean liners going one way. You got to be that little speedboat to go around the place and just keep moving forward. And, you know, that's even now when we're, you know, bigger, just gotta keep going, keep moving. You know, it's, we got it, you know, we don't have a nail, we, you know, we're going the right way, but like, you know, come on, we gotta keep going. And I think at different stages of evolution, companies have different challenges, but, you know, it's the same thing. That forward momentum is what it's all about.
I love that advice. I try to remind myself of that every week. At the start of every week, I'm like, momentum. I only said that yesterday to my wife. I was like, momentum is all I have.
Hitting walls, like, you know, but you got to bounce off and keep going. Just keep going, keep going. And I think there's entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs put them on pedestals, all that kind of stuff. It's resilience. Yeah. It's just fucking resilience. Excuse my language, but it is. Literally getting knocked down and just saying, no, we're going to make it work. And taking the naysayers and all that, and just keep going. And it doesn't happen overnight. You know, as I said, there's many times, if you just use my simple advantage of about the distillery in Dublin, like, you know, I was like, many times, why am I doing this? Like wasting, you know, it feels like I'm wasting all this time, but it was the right thing to do. It was the hardest thing to do. Could have gone to any county and they would have given me grants and open arms. And, you know, I could have gone out to an industrial park off the M50, you know, different things like that. It would have been easier, but it wasn't the right thing to do. and you know, stick at it. And I said, well, I guarantee we'll pave the way and others will follow. And it's, you know, it's true. Now there's four distilleries in Dublin, just within the stone's throw where we are. In two of the locations I looked at, which is quite bizarre. You know, I suppose we broke the ground. We proved that you could do it, and I'm glad there's more, because hopefully it creates a bit of a buzz around the city and so forth.
Do you have any like tips or tricks or things you do to keep that momentum going? Like, you know, it's hard sometimes. You're like, oh, this is just... Is there anything you do or anything you go back to go, right?
I think you have to be able to get some headspace. You know, I'll be honest with you, I found getting, you know, because we were... there's two things that actually helped me a lot in those early days. Because it was so negative in Ireland. It was a tough place to be.
Very bad time to be starting.
There was a lot of negativity around it. It just felt really negative. And I got this great breath of fresh air by going to some of the markets, like nearly, like, you know, meeting customers and seeing the opportunity and reaffirming and getting that energized and seeing, geez, there's a huge opportunity there. So to get out into market and to, it was a verification of what the concept was and what the opportunity was, but also it filled me full of enthusiasm to come back and kind of get stuck into doing it. I found that very, very useful. So, you know, in terms of if you're in Ireland trying to create a global business, get out to the markets to make sure you're doing the right things, but also to draw energy from what you can see out there. And secondly was exercise, because, you know, too easy to fall into, geez, stress, I'll have a drink or two or whatever, like, you know, and it's picky in my industry.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I must get temptations there every day.
I put on a lot of weight and, you know, back in 2014, 2015, but exercise and to get just that headspace away from everyone and just that endorphins kind of release, you know, no matter what, just go to the gym, play football, 5-7 football, you know, go for a run. I used to play a lot of rugby, and then when I stopped doing it, I started running, which is, in a way, it was nearly better because it totaled headspace. You missed the social aspect of the rugby and playing in a group and all that different things like that. But I found with the challenges of my job was, no matter where you were going, you could always carve out half an hour to run the runners and just go out and do it. You control that.
Kind of, you have that time, yeah.
Yeah, it was literally, don't run with music or anything like that, and use the time to think. And just kind of offload some of the, you know, the stuff that goes on. And I still, you know, I've only really kind of got into that over the last 3 years, but I found it quite therapeutic. And also to have another challenge, like, you know, racing and, you know, training through the marathon and so forth, it just gave me something else outside of the work.
You need that, don't you? You need that extra focus.
Yeah.
Just that's nothing to do with the business.
But I always need something, a challenge as well. So be it, you know, I used to manage and captain rugby teams and, you know, like, not at a high level, but, you know, you'd always have the league or something. It was always this other kind of, you know, you can get passionate about it and get behind and put a lot of energy and effort into it. And the same now, training for the Dublin Marathon, it gives you a goal and a sense of achievement to go with what you're doing at work, because sometimes, you know, you don't necessarily, you know, get to where you want to go quite quickly, and it can be very frustrating and just down, like, you know, at least this gave me something else that, oh, I've done my 80 miles the weekend.
Yeah, to start, middle and end as well.
Yeah, so it's just something else to distract the mind from 100%, because that's what it is when you're entrepreneurs. You think about going to bed, first thing you think about when you get up, or you wake up in the middle of the night, you're going, geez, that's what it is, and you have to enjoy it, and you have to be passionate. That's another thing I like to say to people, if they ask, it's like, find something that you actually give a crap about and that you can really do it. And it's not just about the money, it's not about just doing it. You have to really kind of believe in it, because it takes so much of your life, so much of your headspace, that, you know, if you're only doing it for, you know, a perceived end goal of making, I don't think you'll get there.
Never really.
So you really have to believe in it and give it your 100%. Otherwise, you know, you're not set up for success. But it's, no matter what it, it's not hard. If it's hard, everyone would be doing it. That's the reality. You know, it's great to see the shift over even the last 10, 15, 20 years in terms of the entrepreneurial mindset of younger people.
It's incredible. Even now, I feel there's, like, just from all the people I'm talking, it just feels like there's this movement starting with people.
But it's cool to be entrepreneurs.
It is, but there's also like
that's a, but like, very few doing before, it. Like, you know,
I know.
But I, like, I remember I did a talk in UCD I don't know what it was. It was they have, I think it was kind of the entrepreneurs, you know, schedule or something. I don't know what it was, but the amount of people that were planning and not going to university or like, you know, not going into the standards.
Job, yeah.
Job, but going to do something themselves, and they're asking me, is it a good thing to do? And I said, well, look, you know, I don't think you have anything to lose. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll learn probably more doing that than you will in any 100%. Other company.
Yeah.
You know, if you're you have an idea, like, why not? You're probably not set up for success because you still have, you don't know the pitfalls.
Don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, but look, I think that's the difference there in Ireland is that okay, if you set up something that fails, it's not the way it used to be in that you were villainized.
Yeah.
People are saying, well, fair play to you, rather than things. There is still a bit of a, you know, we can't help ourselves in terms of, you know, people who are successful, you know, people are the bastard, like, you know, in terms of begrudgery and so forth. But I think it's a cultural, generational thing, rather than, like, younger people today are much more, they don't see the same way as
It's exciting. It's very exciting. Like, I mean, a lot of people I meet are just, feel they're just on the edge, and they're thinking like yourself. They're thinking globally, which is a huge shift, I think.
Yeah, it's like my wife is. She's kind of she has lots of kind of different issues, smaller businesses. But I was always like, think global. Yeah. Think of what we can take. What you do here, because like that's the opportunity. Because like Ireland's too small for me. You know, a business that's focused on Ireland can, you know, it's great. But reality is, if it doesn't have global potential, you know, you're always very limited in what you can do. But, you know, that's kind of my mindset. And that's because I see that you can, from Ireland, create global brands and global opportunities. And, you know, I think I'm in a very distinctively Irish space that has to be made in Ireland. But, you know, there's no reason why entrepreneurs can come up with any concept.
Mm.
So long as they have that global mindset.
Yeah.
And that you can't get it here. You have to travel. And I think it's great. People go to Canada, go to Australia, go to all these places. Because it really does open up your mind to see, you know, trends in different places. You know, how similar they are, but how different they are at the same time. You know, I think it definitely helped me. Like, I worked every single summer when I was in university in America. I got to Australia. I've traveled all over the world promoting Irish whiskey. That really made, you know, help frame what I'm doing now with Team Whiskey. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have that, I don't think I would have done things in the way that I actually ended up doing. So, you know, all those thankful, you know, early morning flights to God knows where and, you know, sales trips around the Midwestern states of the US, which really were depressing at times, help frame kind of where you are.
So. I think having that mindset as well, just for people who are in jobs, maybe having that mindset of looking, being open and going, oh, when I start my business, I'll be looking, but be looking now when you're in the job
definitely.
As well.
Oh, definitely. Oh, without a doubt. Like, you know, I don't think if you leave yourself, I'm going to leave and then come up with the idea. Yeah. I think that's, you know what, people never do it.
No. It's a bam. People often contact me going, oh, I'm, you know, I want to start my business, but, you know, blah, 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 blah. When I leave, I'm like, you're using the comfort of your job to give yourself that idea of, oh, when I leave, I'll be happy. You know, it's just looking now, starting and starting when you're still in the job as well.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. I think about, like, as I said, it was I was in an entrepreneur type culture. It was kind of, it just seemed normal enough to always be looking at different angles and opportunities. So I had my own kind of little notepad of ideas and so forth that I still have, like, you know, I still do it. That wasn't a great idea, thank God I didn't do that.
Yeah, my mate, we were waiting for our lads weekend to go over there last weekend when the mates were taking the piss out of me about the podcast going, oh, put that in your ideas book now, Foxy, and I was like, I will put that. Yeah. We saw something cool, it was in business in Galway, so I was like, that's, I will put that in my book.
You know, it's true, it's those little things and you don't know when you can come back and cultivate them, so that's...
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first idea I wrote in my ideas book. I started on holidays like 5 years ago. It was the first idea and I kept coming back and that was the business I ran it. So it does, because you got to put it down, you got to flesh it out. And it's the one you keep coming back to, I think, is the one, like yourself, the Irish Whiskey, is the one. What book would you recommend for people?
Jesus, like, you know, it's because I've been thinking about it in the back of my mind going, God, now I'm gonna look like some.
It can be audible. Gary Lavin from Vit Hit, he was like, I don't read anymore, I'll give you an audible suggestion. I was like, no problem.
Yeah, no, it's like I reel up and I'm not great at the old self-help. Like I remember when I was working, I was reading about different master techniques and all the kind of stuff like that.
No, it can be anything. I get the most from non-fiction that reads like fiction. So like Bad Blood last year was a great one. You know, anything that's, it doesn't have to be self-help, it can be anything you, even, you know, it can be fiction, it can be anything you found that's got some sort of value out, or even just enjoy it.
I've read a lot of just kind of fiction books to kind of shut down, like, you know, to help unwind.
Same, yeah. I read fiction before bed, non-fiction during the day.
Yeah, so you're always trying to have a balance of different, but like, you know, there's a whole host of different ones. It's been a while since I read a business book and like, wow, there's something that really kind of... Yeah, you should have told me. I would have definitely done my research before and come up with something very, very clever.
Joe will do. We'll give away a bottle of Teeling whiskey.
Definitely, yeah.
Which one would you recommend? That's like, choose your favorite child.
Oh, well, I'd choose it, right? Who's buying?
Oh, I'll buy it. I'll go in and get it and we can give it. Well, we didn't have a budget, of course.
Yeah.
It's a free podcast.
Yeah, I would say, for me, there's two ones that I would always think would be a good one too. One would be our small batch, because it was the very first product we launched.
Yeah.
For me, it's our disruptor within the space, if there is such a thing within our industry, yeah. In terms of trying to do something very innovative within blended whiskey, which is the lion's share of Irish whiskey sales, and it's our flagship. The other one could be our distillery exclusive, which focus on very unique different types of casks. Mm-hmm. And the one that we currently have at the moment is our Chinkapin American oak cask.
Okay.
Two of them are quite unique and interesting, and I'm more than happy to donate such a good cause, and you can choose yourself. And
I think this is going to be the most entered competition we've ever had.
And I'll throw in a few passes to the distillery as well for whoever it is. This is much better than choosing a book.
That's much more interesting as well.
So they have an experience.
I'm going to see a theme coming here.
So this is educational, so they get to learn about how to make.
Precisely. I think we're on a winner. So all they got to do is tag Teeling Whiskey and myself in the social posting and tag it on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, whichever. Just make sure to tag both of us in it, and that's it. And they can win a chance to come up and visit you guys here.
Great.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No worries. No worries. My pleasure.
And that was episode 26 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I somehow feel I'm going to set a worrying precedent by giving away a bottle of whiskey, as it'll be probably our most popular giveaway yet. So I'm sitting here in the studio with a bottle of Teeling Whiskey Small Batch in my hand. I also have two complimentary guided tour passes, complimentary of Jack Teeling, for a tour of their distillery. I actually was up there about 2 months ago and did it with a good friend of mine, Dave. It is a fantastic tour and just great crack, and it's a really nice place. So if you want to win a bottle of Teeling Whiskey Small Batch and guided tour for two around the Teeling Distillery in the Liberties in Dublin, simply share this episode, tag me, Mr. Gary Fox, and tag Teeling Whiskey. So no matter what social media you're on, the guys are on all them, and so am I. So whether it's Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, just make sure to tag us. Otherwise, I don't know you've entered. I don't even know the procedure for this, but probably say something like, you should be over 18 if you want to win the prize. Something along those lines, responsible drinking, etc., etc. That is episode 26. I hope you enjoyed it. I will see you next Thursday at 6 a.m. for another episode. See you then.